it there.
No, I'm here yesterday. Right there.
Well, you're owned by this.
Maury. 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 Apparently the senators are on time.
Yes. I'm impressed. It's not ours. We will call the meeting to order. This is the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. This is the second two-day meeting out of three that we planned this fall. Back in September, we had a very successful two-day meeting where we covered a lot of important topics to bring the commission fully up to speed on some of the key issues that we are needing to address as a commission. And we'll continue that today. We will meet no later than until 5 o'clock today. If we finish our agenda before then, we will adjourn. For those of you that have the agenda, the last three items are scheduled for tomorrow. And I will note as well, we're going to have to change the order on the agenda. Item 5 is going to have to be moved up to be considered first in order to accommodate our presenters and their schedules. And so we will do that first of all. You have before you the minutes of our September 21 and 22 meeting. What's your pleasure?
So moved.
Moved by Representative Kiffmeyer. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Give you a moment to speed read. If there are no additions or corrections, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. In preparing an agenda for today, we identified at our last meeting a whole series of potential topics, and we sent out a survey, and that didn't seem to work too well.
Mr. Chairman, it reflects the absolute confidence in your judgment.
Well, thank you for that. But we're going to follow a little different practice setting the agenda for November, and I want to forewarn you here now at the start that before we conclude tomorrow, I want us to have a discussion and an agreement, a consensus among the membership here as to what topics we want to be sure and cover at our November meeting. And I would suggest that probably about half of our November meeting be devoted to talking about which of the issues we want to pursue in terms of possible recommendations, changes, whatever, to the legislature. Not that we're going to have a bill at that point to consider, but if there are things that we as a commission want to address by way of changes or adjustments, I'd like for us to come to that conclusion by the end of the meeting in November so that we can be about the business. We do have a backlog of bills that have already been introduced, and we'll have that for you, too, at our next meeting. Not to go through in detail, only if there are particular questions or further background information that may be needed. But we want to give everybody a heads up as to what will be on our agenda for possible hearing and consideration come January with our regular session. So if you would please, before we adjourn tomorrow, be thinking about what you want to make sure we cover at the November meeting, in addition to what I just suggested, that we spend some significant time in discussing which of the issues we want to move forward with possible recommendations. So any questions about the game plan for today and tomorrow?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe on the minutes, the last page, you do have the interim topics that I think pretty well summarize all of our thoughts, and that's probably why we didn't do the surveys. Right.
Excuses will be accepted. obviously, it was a interesting idea, but it didn't work, so we'll try a different tactic. We'll try a different tactic this time around. Any other questions or comments about today or tomorrow and what the plan would be? If not, let us proceed with our agenda. And first of all, I wanted to give Mr. Martin an opportunity to update the commission on a few things that have transpired since our last meeting so that everybody is kind of up to speed on a few of those items. So, Mr. Martin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, two things I wanted to draw your attention to. One, internal with the commission budget. Commission contract with Milliman. We did reformulate that based on your motion last time, and it has been executed by both the chair and by Milliman. So we now have Milliman under contract, and so when they appear later today covering the 2010 valuations, you can feel free to ask them questions because they're now on our hourly rate, and they work for us. The other relates to the Minneapolis Police and Fire. If you remember during the 2011 special session, a consolidation of the Minneapolis Police and Fire with PRA Police and Fire was approved, subject to a number of local approvals and approval by PRA. Happy to note that the approvals have occurred by the pension funds involved, the membership of the Minneapolis Police and Fire, the Minneapolis City Council, and by PERA. So the consolidation of those two plans is set forth for December 31st. So that was a loose end, pending a lot of local approvals and other approvals, and that's where it stands. And Ms. Vanek will be appearing before us on a different matter, but she might want to make a few comments about how that process may be going and how difficult or not difficult it is.
Any questions regarding those matters? Well, it's nice to have the Minneapolis Police and Fire behind us after a long, long struggle, right, Senator?
25 years.
25. Okay, let us proceed with our agenda. And as I mentioned, item 5 is moved up to begin, and we want to call on first Patrice Beckham to come forward and
good afternoon.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. It's our pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. Just a little bit of background on both of us. My name is Patrice Beckham, and I have with me my colleague, Brent Bannister. And we both work for Kavanaugh McDonald Consulting, which is an actuarial consulting firm that specializes and works exclusively for governmental employers. We've been with Kavanaugh McDonald a little over a year, And prior to that, we actually worked for Milliman, and we worked on the LCPR contract, and I served with Bill as the actuary to the commission. It was kind of an interesting switch in a little over a year to be in a different role, but it's our pleasure to be here with you today, and we appreciate your time. Brent, I'm going to turn it over to Brent, and he's going to kind of start us off and give us a little bit of background and overview on the interest rate assumption and its purpose and its importance, and then we'll dig into the details a little bit further. If you have questions at any time, please feel free to ask them. You don't need to wait till the end. So, Brent?
Mr. Bannister, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have, or you have in front of you, I believe, the presentation we'll be going through, and slide two just gives kind of the overview of where we'll be heading this afternoon. And talking again about the interest rate assumption, how it gets set, what it's used for, and so forth. Slide three, just kind of stepping back a little bit and saying, why is there an interest rate assumption in the first place? I think, you know, we all think we know, but I thought it would be good just to kind of refresh our thinking here. Pension funding is a long-term proposition. The teachers just started school here the last couple months. Some of those new teachers, 22 years old, they're going to be still receiving retirement benefits 80, 90 years from now. So there's a long period of time for which a pension fund has to look. To do our calculations in a kind of a meaningful way, we have to get everything adjusted on kind of the present value, what things are worth now. If we were doing some sort of short-term projection over 3, 4, 5 years, we could just say a dollar is a dollar, it'd be close enough, it wouldn't be a real concern. But over the 80 and 90-year period, a dollar is not a dollar. I can remember my grandfather telling me stories about, you know, when they went and bought a bag of bananas for a dollar and, you know, 20-pound bag. You don't do that anymore. He did. But that's 80 or 90 years ago. When we look at 80 or 90 years from now, things will be different. So what we really want to know is, what does a dollar in the trust say 10 years from now? If we were going to contribute a dollar in 10 years, what would that look like now? And so we need to say, well, what is the amount that put into the trust today would grow to be a dollar in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and so forth? So we can be putting everything on kind of a fair basis of what a dollar really means then or now. And so that's where this discount rate comes in, is how is it we're going to convert the dollar in the future to some different amount now. And it really is designed to say, what is it that will be earned in the trust over that period of time? Because the dollar put in now, or the 50 cents put in now, will grow in the trust until ultimately it is paid out as a benefit. So from the actuarial perspective, it's what is happening in the trust to that money. Slide four, as we talk about assumptions, and this is true of all actuarial assumptions, there's no single correct assumption that every actuary will look at and say, that's the right number. There's a blend of science and kind of art. We come up with ranges. There's no way around it. There's no single item that everybody will say, that is clearly the right number. We will have these ranges. These are long-term estimates. Again, we're thinking about the 30, 40, 50 years, 80 and 90 years even, over which these benefits are being provided. And we know that they're going to be, some years will be higher, some years will be lower. Now, again, that's true of any assumption. Some years will be one direction, some will be the other. We're trying to find that number that sort of represents the best estimate of the long-term state of things. But, as I'm sure you're familiar, what we assume is not what really drives the cost of the plan. The actuarial assumptions may determine how the funding is allocated at this point in time, but ultimately what drives the cost of the plan is, what are the actual benefits paid out, and when are they paid? And that's independent of the actuarial assumptions. to the extent the actuarial assumptions are close, it will make the funding and the payouts work more harmoniously. And so that's why we want to have good assumptions. You know, too conservative, you put more money in now and less in later. Not conservative enough, less money goes in now, more money goes in later. So we really are trying to find this best estimate of the long-term state so we can kind of smooth everything out. Slide 5, as we start looking at the investment return assumption, actuarial practice, we have standards that we look to, as well as just kind of the professional experience we have. Inflation is one thing that we need to consider because it affects the return on investments, it affects the salary increases being granted. It's connected in to varying degrees with COLAs that are provided. And so once we have that sense of what's inflation going to look like over time, we also need to consider what is the portfolio of assets expected to return on a real basis. We pull out inflation, what will the real return be? So we'll be talking a lot today about what's that real return on assets. And again, we come back to, we're looking at a very long time period. 30 to 50 years is kind of where the core of what we're looking at would occur. The short term matters, the real long term matters, but that 30, 40, 50 years is a very key kind of range for us to be thinking about. What will returns be in that period of time? So we'll be looking both at what's happened in the past, what do we expect to happen in the future? How do we use all of that information to, again, try to get the best estimate of what we expect to see over the next 30, 40, 50 years and beyond?
On slide 6, we are trained as actuaries and not as investment experts or professionals, and therefore we rely on those who are the experts to provide the capital market assumptions that we use when we're doing our kind of forward-looking analysis. And, you know, those are set generally by the investment professional working with the fund. In this case, the State Board of Investment actually has a nice survey of 8 different investment firms that provide them information. As Brent said, we focus on the real rate of return, so kind of pulling out the inflation assumption. And then based on the asset allocation, determine the expected return based on that asset allocation and those capital market assumptions. And the asset allocation is extremely important. It's probably the single most important driver in what that ultimate investment return assumption is. And I think it's worth noting that in your situation, the asset allocation for SBI is more aggressive than what we might find if we went to the public funds survey, the 120 or so large public plans that are in that survey. On average, they might have about a 65% equities and 35% bond and cash allocation, and SBI is more like 80-20. So it's important to keep that in mind when you look at average statistics, that asset allocation could be a big part of that difference. As Brent mentioned, the total investment return assumption obviously does have a component of inflation, and we use what actuaries refer to as the building block approach, which again is developing the real rate of return for the portfolio and then adding to it the inflation assumption, which is 3%, to come up with the total return. If you would turn to slide 7, I wanted to talk a little bit from the actuarial perspective of the challenges that we see in using the capital market assumptions. Obviously, we need to look at that information. It's important. It's not information we can develop on our own. But in all of our analysis, actuaries gather a lot of data, and then they have to kind of evaluate that data and assign credibility to it. So that's kind of the part of the process where we're trying to assign the credibility to some of this. Capital market assumptions generally change at least every year, sometimes more frequently. We've seen them change every quarter for certain investment professionals. So, again, we're trying to set a very long-term return, 50-year return, and yet we know that what we're looking at now for capital market assumptions could look very different a year from now. That's been part of the process in the past. In addition to that, it doesn't look like there's real consensus among those who are indeed investment experts. And the next slide, I think, will illustrate that quite clearly. But there's a wide range of expectations by asset class for different investment professionals. And for the eight firms that were in the SBI study, if we just look at the real rate of return, the low was just over 4%, and the high was almost 6.5%. So with a 3% inflation assumption, you know, we'd be looking at a range from 7 to 9.5. That's a pretty wide range. And I think that makes it more difficult for us to get comfortable with, you know, kind of what do you do with this information and how much credibility do you really assign to it at this point in time. The other issue related to capital market assumptions are they are typically set for a period of about 10 years. There's a few firms that set them for longer. But again, in the survey from SBI, most of those were a 10-year horizon. And again, that's a shorter time frame than we as actuaries are trying to shoot for. We're looking at the stream of benefit payments over a very, very long period. And that's, I think, the real difference kind of between the way the investment professionals use this information and the way the actuaries use it. It's the time frame and the perspective. And clearly, you know, I think that the capital market assumptions can be influenced by, you know, what has happened recently. And it's understandable, given what's happened in the last few years. If you look at slide 8, this looks like a rather busy graph, but hopefully we can explain it to you. It just shows across the bottom the different asset classes. And then each one of those little marks represents one of the eight firms in the SBI study and what their real return assumption was for that asset class. So, for instance, for the U.S. large, the lowest was 4%, and the highest was 7.1%. And you can look, you look up that line, you can kind of see where the distribution of assumptions were. Same with the small U.S. small was 4.65% to 6.25%. Again, the thing that strikes us on this is in almost every asset class, there's quite a bit of difference in where those real rates of return lie. And in some of them, it's amazingly different, like emerging markets, 4% low to 9.5% high. I mean, that is just a very wide range. And it's not the same firms that are low on all of them. They're kind of mixed up. So again, when you're trying to assign credibility to this, and these are the experts, and they know far more than I do, and there obviously is not sort of a central camp there where they're all on the same page. So that makes it more difficult when we're doing this forward-looking analysis to decide what we do with that and how much weight that should carry in the final analysis. Brent mentioned that in addition to sort of the forward-looking analysis and future expectations, we do look at historical analysis. We tend, again, to want to look at that in long-term historical analysis. So over the last 20 years, State Board of Investment has returned 8.8%, and since 1980, the return's been over 10%. We know the standard disclaimer, past performance is not necessarily an indicator of future experience, but I think it is important information. It does provide some perspective. And we've had a number of significant events in our history that are reflected when we look at the very, very long-term economic experience. slide 10 shows the year-by-year returns for SBI, historical returns from 1981 forward. And that points out a couple of issues. You know, the 8.5% assumption was met or exceeded in 20 of those 31 years. And it was below 8.5% in 11 years. Five of those have been the last decade. The thing I really like, and we've done this analysis for a number of clients, and it's almost consistently the same answer. In that 30-year period, how many times was the return close to 8.5? Once here, the other clients I've done it for, it's generally one or two times. And that's the world we live in. It's either way high or way low, and it's that volatility that really creates the challenge. Well, another way to look at historical analysis is to take sort of all of the available statistical information and look at a longer period, so like a 30-year period, and then move that 30-year period 1 year each year. And that's what we did on slide 11. Now, a lot of the current asset classes don't have history that goes, you know, back to the 1920s. So granted, this is a little simplistic, but it's hypothetical. So it's simply looking at an allocation, asset allocation, 80% S&P 500 and 20% corporate bonds. And so the first bar on the far left that says 1955, that's the compound return from 1925 to 1955, that 30-year period. The next bar would represent 1926 to 56. So every bar is a 30-year return, and it's just moving, taking that 30-year period and moving forward 1 year each year through time. Again, trying to take the available information and look at it with that long-term lens on. And essentially, given this type of an asset allocation, you know, the return was at or above 8.5 all but two of those years. Again, this is looking back, but this is sort of reliable information that's already happened, and we're trying to blend that with the forward-looking analysis. Slide 12, if you look at that slide, the blue line is exactly the information you just looked at on the prior slide. It's that 30-year rolling return. The red line is the same type of analysis, but over a 10-year period. And I think what this illustrates is sort of the difference in perspective and how dramatic that difference is at certain points in time, between perhaps a 10-year average, which tends to be what the investment professionals are focusing on, versus a 30-year or longer-term period, which is the blue line, tends to be a little more smooth. On slide 13, just some considerations. Obviously, this is a very important decision. The investment return assumption is probably the single most powerful assumption that's used in the actuarial evaluation process. I wanted to mention one thing that isn't on that slide that I did see on your agenda for tomorrow was some discussion on the new accounting rules from the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And those rules are going to make some pretty significant changes, in particular for cost-sharing multiple employer plans like TRA, where the unfunded liability for the system will now be allocated to each employer who participates in the system, and they will have to show that unfunded liability on their balance sheet. So clearly, you know, the investment return assumption, in the past, those entities that participated in TRA, as long as they put in their statutory contribution rate, there was no liability on their books. Okay, the new GASB rules are making a very dramatic change in direction on how these plans are accounted for and how the unfunded liability is now going to be essentially allocated to everyone that's participating in the plan. So a higher unfunded liability obviously means the piece that each employer gets will be higher. So it's going to have an additional impact to what it would have had those new GASB rules not be coming down the line. Those likely won't be effective till maybe fiscal year 13 or 14. The final draft is not out yet, but it's quite the hot topic in the public pension arena right now. In addition, a couple other considerations. Brent talked a little bit about the intergenerational equity. That, you know, in a perfect world, we're trying to assign the cost of these benefits to the years that are being worked and essentially to the members and the taxpayers. Obviously, the challenge is nobody knows what the future holds for the next year, let alone about the next 30 or 50. And so we're trying to kind of strike that that middle ground, not being overly conservative or overly aggressive, recognizing that if we do that either direction, we're really shifting costs, and that's probably not desirable. Again, it's a long-term proposition. There's really, at least in my mind, there's not a rush that, you know, the decision needs to be made immediately. The systems do an experience study every 4 years. There will be another one coming up in May of 2013. The next experience study will be issued. The investment return assumption is reviewed, as is every other assumption and method that's used in the valuation process. And then there's sort of kind of a practical side to this, which is for TRA, the contribution rates are phasing or increasing, the employer and the member, 2% over a four-year period. And this is the first of that four-year period. And then, the COLA doesn't change until the plan is 90% funded. So from kind of a practical standpoint, the money coming in and the benefit payments going out aren't going to change before the next experience study is done. So again, there may be not a compelling reason to rush to a decision. We think that it's important that you really take your time, do careful and thorough analysis. We've been through this with a number of clients, and it is kind of a process. There's a lot of education there, and there's no easy answer. Otherwise, probably those decisions would be made quicker. So we thought maybe we'd just lay out several options on the last slide, on slide 14. Again, maintaining that long-term perspective, you could keep the current rate, the 8.5, for now, and you know that it's going to be reviewed every 4 years as part of the experience study. In addition, the valuation process itself will capture any difference in any assumption versus actual experience from year to year. So it's a little bit of a self-correcting process. So at least for the short term, that addresses any concern. Clearly, you could change the rate. Even if you change it, the experience study will continue to review it and analyze it. If you do change the rate, you know, you could do it kind of immediately, put it into effect right after the legislation's passed. You might want to consider phasing it in to create a little bit more stability in the contribution rates. Certainly something to think about. And then we wanted to take a little bit of time to talk to you about this new approach, and I'll be honest with you, it's so far not commonly used, but there's a lot of interest in it. And we use a select and ultimate approach in other types of actuarial assumptions. We just haven't seen it as commonly for the investment return assumption. But essentially, you use a different rate for an initial period of time, and that's called the select period. And you know, you can pick that time frame. I think in our letter to TRA that you have probably seen, the recommendation was 6 years, and that was really to make it fit into the experience study timing. The only system we know of, statewide system we know that's using this, is the state of Vermont. And Brent, is it 15 years? There's a select period. So there, you know, there's no magic about the select period. But then after that initial period, they use one rate for an initial period, let's just say 10 years to make it easy. So you use that for 10 years, and then it would go to your ultimate, a different rate that would then be used for that year and all future years. Okay, so it's the select, a lower rate, well, wouldn't have to be lower, but right now it likely would be, a lower rate would be used for the select period and a higher rate for years thereafter, as far as the benefit payments that are expected in those years. I think part of the appeal with select and ultimate, at least what we are hearing from boards that we work with, is that it's very challenging for boards and legislatures to kind of deal with this difference between the time horizon that the investment professionals are focused on versus the time horizon that the actuaries are focused on. And that's understandable. And this approach allows you to sort of, you know, marry those two pretty easily, saying we can follow more what the investment professionals are saying for the short term, but go with more historical long-term experience for the ultimate rate. Okay. And it obviously, if you lower the assumption for a given period, 6 or 10 years, and then you kept the 8.5, the impact would be less than if you lowered it to the select and kept and used that for all years. So it sort of is a nice combination, again, that embraces that difference between short-term perspective versus long-term. You know, we participate and go to a lot of meetings, the National Conference on Teacher Retirement, National Association of State Retirement Administrators. We sit through a lot of board meetings with investment professionals. We work with those professionals when we're doing experience studies. And the focus and the concern does seem to be more short-term, that I hear more positive things with a longer-term perspective. And so this was one idea, you know, we did discuss with the board, the TRA board, just as an idea or a consideration, and we wanted to take time and make sure that we explain that to you today. So we would be happy to answer any questions you have for us with respect to this or anything else in our presentation.
Well, thank you, Ms. Beckham. I have a couple of questions. If you go to slide 8, it's interesting to note that there's only a few of those marks, handful of those marks, that exceed 8.5%. As you pointed out, you have spreads, significant spreads of 4 to 7 or even from 4 to 9.5. But there are very few that exceed 8.5. And doesn't that suggest maybe a little more caution here about where we set our assumptions?
I'm very glad you asked that, because I need to clarify that. As I look at that slide, I don't see a very critical word that needs to be on there, which is that these are the real rates of return. These are net of inflation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to think about it in terms of total, you would add 3% to each of these. So for U.S. large, it'd actually be, if you add in the 3% inflation, it would be 7 to 10.1. And U.S. small would be 7.65 to 9.25. So these are indeed real rates of return. These correlate to the prior slide that said the range, for, given the asset allocation, the range on the real return was 4.03 to 6.49. So I apologize that that was not clear. These are real rates of return. And when you're looking at 8.5, that's really a 5.5 real rate of return. Strip out the inflation.
Okay, the second question. You know, I certainly understand, you know, a view of 40, 50 years. If someone is hired today and they work the next 40, 50 years, you would want to make sure you have a long-term look at it. But the reality is that someone hired today, or those who have been hired here in the last few years, are going to be paying in, covering people who are already retired or about to retire. And if they're not paying in enough to keep up the commitments, to support the commitments that have been made, doesn't that suggest maybe a more conservative assumption of earnings. And if I look at the chart on 12, I think it's particularly startling the 10-year, the red line. What happens if that red line continues to be way down like it has been in the last few years, where we've got rates of return well below 8.5% for the next 10 years or the next 10 years after next year, and et cetera. That, to me, that's an alarming chart, looking at the 10-year history. And if you go back in the last 10 years, a number of our funds have done less than 5% over the last 10 years. And 10 years is long-term, too. I realize it's not a 40-50 year, but and so a chart like this concerns me. You want to speak to that?
I would be happy to. I think we would say, from the actuarial perspective, we're looking and giving more credibility to the blue line. I mean, you can see that, was that about 1974, the 10-year average was quite low as well, and it worked its way back up. Obviously, the slide we just looked at with the eight different investment professionals and their assumptions, they have different ideas about what the next 10 years look like. I'm not an investment professional, but again, the 10 years, and I guess the point on this slide was to illustrate that you're going to see a lot more difference in the 10-year returns than you are 30 years. Mm-hmm. And we're in it for the long haul. 30, 40, 50, I mean, the average age of your member is 40. You know, half of those people are likely to live, you know, to 80 or beyond. So it's a long-term process, and we're trying to make sure the actuarial assumptions again fit that time frame. And when we look historically, 10 is up and down and up and down, but 30 is, it's not level, but it's much more stable. So not saying the next 10 years aren't important, because they clearly are, but if we at least look at what history has done, you know, even given the last 10 years, which have been a very, very bad investment experience, you know, the 30-year average is still, you know, above 10%. So, I don't know, Brett, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Again, I mean, there's obviously that issue of, yes, what if it does continue to be bad? And that's where, I guess, is one thing we're looking at this every 4 years and saying, where are we? So at some point, we would definitely say we really have had a fundamental change, and the way things used to be has changed. I don't know if we are there yet. So but that is one thing that does help, is every 4 years we are doing a systematic reevaluation. The other thing we want to be careful with is if we say, well, because it could be bad, let's pump more money in now, we are asking current employees and current taxpayers to really be paying ahead just in case it's not good in the future. And there may be some, you know, again, that's a policy issue of where's that risk lie. But that is one thing to be aware of, is we don't want to necessarily overpay now and then find out 15, 20 years from now, you know, we really put too much in there and kind of at the expense of other projects that could have occurred 15, 20 years ago. So that's the line we're always trying to balance.
Well, I understand. To me, the red line is a red flag. And I personally think that we're in a different world today when it comes to investment returns. And I don't have the same optimism that 30-year line is going to continue to be at the level it is. And the reason I feel that way is what's been happening with the 10-year trend line. So, further questions? Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I actually had the kind of opposite reaction that you had looking at these slides. First of all, I looked at slide 11, which I thought was a much more relevant slide to look at than slide 12, and saw that compounded returns have just stayed up so high, you know, consistently. It's not until before even my time in the legislature did it ever dip below the, that 8.5%. So that gives me a fair amount of confidence that we're on the right track. And I guess I don't like, I think it's just following over the last comments, I don't like requiring much more contributions now because we're afraid that something might happen when the historical record shows us that it hasn't happened. And then the other question, and I think you were kind of talking about this one too, is the statement on the top of 13, slide 13, the intergenerational equity. Current taxpayers should pay for current services by current employees. I don't quite understand how that works in a pension system because you're always paying for the past. What you're paying, the amounts that go out while you're there is you're paying for the past employees, because the current employees aren't on the pension system. So I don't quite understand how that statement works.
Well, actuarial funding, sort of in its pure sense, is intended for contributions to come in from the members and the employer while that person is working that will be sufficient when they retire to pay their benefits until the last dollar they die and the last benefit payment is made. And that piece is sort of the normal cost, that ongoing cost of the benefit. And that cost is being made. The challenge with pension funding is experience doesn't follow our assumptions, darn it. People don't die on schedule. They don't get salary increases exactly. And so there's an unfunded liability or, in some situations, surplus, where you're sort of ahead of target or behind target, and then you have to put an additional amount in, and it changes every year.
Well, you know, the problem when you get back to slide 11, it doesn't look as if historically that's a problem. And I don't think you have a problem unless you can't make the payments in a year. And then I think you have the ability. So I think what you're saying in the first one, you know, keep the current rate for now, experience studies will continue to examine its appropriateness. It's kind of, again, as I look at the history and then look at the fact that we're not expecting, you know, the problem that we've seen in the private pension market is that a fund goes out of business and the pensioners are totally, we're not bad as we think government may be, we're not really expecting it to go out of business. And so you're always going, and I think you'll have enough warning, even if we're cutting way back on employees at some point, you've kind of got enough warning to be making the current pension, you know, pension payments, and out multiple years. And I'm just saying I think that you have enough time to do the adjustment if they look. What I've always said is that the two important lines that you want to look at is you want to look at the incoming money from both investments and from contributions and the outgoing. And they're both going up. And as long as those slopes are going kind of parallel and not really diverging, I think you're okay in terms of pension fund. I know that's a very simplistic elementary arithmetic view as opposed to an actuarial view, but, you know, I never got much past geometry, so I kind of like
well,
that.
You're on the right track, and what you say is true. Obviously, you really don't ever want to be in a situation where you're worried about making benefit payments, and that's why when there isn't.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Aren't some states in that position now?
I'm not aware of any states that are at risk of not being able to make benefit payments in the near term.
Okay.
The issue is, in order to avoid that, when we do the valuation and you're kind of off target, that's why you start putting some money in. You know, such a big number, you start putting money in now, and then it adjusts every year as that experience unfolds. What I wanted to point to was slide 10, you know, where since 1980, the return for SBI has been over 10%. But slide 10 shows you the wild ride over that 30-year period. And that's the problem, that the experience, it not only deviates from the assumption or the average return, it deviates significantly up and down. And that's the challenge we face as actuaries trying to assist the systems and legislatures in trying to fund these plans is, again, if we could be guaranteed that, you know, it would never be above 9.5 or less than 7.5, it'd be a whole lot easier to fund this on a level percent of pay basis. But slide 10 shows you the reality of the returns. Even though the compound return has been over 10%, it's been very, very volatile.
Representative Kahn.
The point I keep trying to make is that that volatility doesn't really matter since you're not dependent on making your that big down doesn't give you any problem in the current time. I'm just saying that the much more relevant graph is the one on 11.
And I understand your point.
And unless if 11 was, you know, I don't know why we weren't maybe more worried at the times when it was lower. But I would, you know, if 11 suddenly started to go down a lot, those blue lines, you know, I would find much more ability to worry that I am now, that I have now.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments. I don't know, friends, do you have anything you want to
I think the one comment I would make on slide 11 is it's not going to do anything suddenly because it is a 30-year average. And so if we really have experienced a fundamental change, which there's no way, I mean, I have no way of knowing. I don't know that anybody can know until we get where we have hindsight. But if that really has occurred, it will show a continued downward slope there. But again, it'll take us 5, 10, 15 years before we really can say, yep, that's what happened.
But, Mr. Chairman, the 10-year average is even higher. So, I mean, I guess we'd need to look at the 5-year. You know, I mean, we can look at those, but, you know, I don't know. I have no idea which one is the most relevant. But if you say we should use a shorter period, then that's the 10-year average is even more optimistic. And I think this year's is even better, isn't it?
Yeah, the return for fiscal year 11 was very strong.
Yeah.
But again, so it's more the long-term perspective. And I think what Brent was saying is, you know, 10 years from now, whatever happens in the next 10 years gets averaged in with sure. the last decade, which was difficult, but then the 90s, which were good. So if there is indeed a fundamental shift, in a 30-year rolling average, it won't manifest itself for a long time. And I think that's part of it is, you know, is there enough evidence that it absolutely has changed and it's never going to be the way it looks over this extremely long period, which covers an awful lot of significant events in our history. Well, if the judgment, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, I think, on that one. It's nobody has a crystal ball that works.
Mr. Chair, just one last comment. I'd be much more likely to be worried if that 10-year average was, the last 10-year average was lower instead of higher.
The 10-year average is lower.
10-year is lower.
I thought it was 10.
No.
10%. Where was that?
No, the 10.
No, that's 30. Since 1980, the fund was 10%, 10.13. Last 20 was 8.8. I don't know that I have the last.
That's 1909. Right. No. What's 10? What's
the
10?
Red?
What's 10? Yeah. What's the red line in 10?
It's
not
that's 8.5%.
Oh, I'm sorry.
10.
Yes.
So even during
the
red. On 12. On chart. Yeah. Pardon me.
The red line.
Oh,
well. Three.
I think the two charts end at different times, and so. The question, I think, directly to Representative Kahn's issue is right now is, on chart 12, mm-hmm. you don't have 11 data, but you have 10 data. Where's that red line in 10?
2010?
2010.
But the problem with the red line on 12 is it's a 10-year average.
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'd want...
Oh, yeah.
even with the returns in 11, it's not going to be dramatically.
I'm not sure. I'd like to know.
Okay.
You might be right, Mr. Chairman. But the charts end at different times, and it helps if you kind of sync them.
They are ending at the same, the 2010, but the red line would be the 10 years, the decade, that the lost decade, as they keep calling it. And that return, I don't have the numbers, but it looks like it's maybe 3.5%. The red line. The far right, are we looking at the same point? Yeah. Okay.
There's a dramatic increase in the short term.
Yeah. Well, because, yeah, I mean, from...
2010 was a good year.
Yeah, and 11 will be another good year. But
11 will be another good year.
Yeah. And so that's going to have a bigger impact on a 10-year average than it is a 30-year average.
Right. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the answer is.
Thank you, Dr. Bannister and Ms. Beckham, for your presentation. And the data is very helpful as policymakers are trying to make these decisions, very important long-term decisions. Kavanaugh McDonald does this actuary work for public pensions alone or for also for private pensions?
No, for public governmental pension plans only.
Only. Okay. Do you discuss any of the assumptions that are made with other firms as they do private pension work? Does that conversation ever come up, those kinds of discussions, the assumptions that private pension funds make?
We actually,
Ms. Beckham?
Yes. We actually just had a short conversation with Mr. Hoke and Mr. Herman ahead of this meeting. When Brent and I were working for Milliman, we actually did some work for corporate sector clients, so we're familiar with what those rules and the conversation we were having is what's going on with interest rates right now, because that is a heavy driver in the required contributions for corporate plans.
Mr. Chair, as we're looking at or having discussions around that 8.5% assumed rate of return for these plans, we're also, some of us are looking at how it's done in the private sector, if there are some analogies and comparisons that can be made. When you did that work, or not just in the past but presently, as you look at those assumed rates of return in the private sector, do you know what those numbers are? Are you familiar with that?
Ms. Beckham.
I'd just like to get your input, because I've done some studying, and I have some numbers that I want to share, but I just want to ask you first.
I can't remember.
The current numbers are very low because they're basically required to tie their numbers essentially to what the underlying methodology are the U.S. Treasury yields. So what a high-quality bond, very high-quality bond index is, as opposed to what their portfolio might earn. Because the federal government's concerned about not taking on any pension liability should a company fail, they want to be very conservative. They're not looking at a long-term assumed return. They're looking at what could we go out and match up treasuries with right now. And those rates are... I think they're hovering four point something at this point. It varies month to month.
If I could just add to that, clearly the changes that the Pension Protection Act that was passed in 2006 made significant changes for funding of private pension plans that started in about 2008. But the focus, as Brent said, in the corporate world, it's very different. Obviously, companies can go bankrupt at any time, they can merge. So the focus in those changes was trying to make sure plans were funded to cover benefits that were already accrued and earned, so that if anything happened, there would be money to pay those folks, and it would not become the government's liability from the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation. Prior to the Pension Protection Act, the methodologies in the corporate sector were similar to what we use What was used in private sector is similar to what we now use, and we've always used in public sector as well, where we were using a long-term rate of return to discount those expected benefit payments, and it was a projection that included future service and future salary, not just the benefits that were earned. But again, it's difficult, I think, to make an analogy with the private sector and public because they're different in so, so many ways, and the issues are different, and the government's involved, and they have a vested interest in the funding of those plans as well. We're obviously our time horizon when we look at Minnesota, you know, it's not likely you're going to merge with the state of South Dakota, or, you know, there's not, that type of thing is not going on in the public sector environment, which allows us to ignore a lot of the shorter term issues that corporate plans face and focus more on the long term funding. I hope that helps.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chair, one other related question, and that is, as you look at the charts on 11 and 12, and I think there's Warren Buffett, there's Peter Lynch, and there's Howard Vicker, you know, here in Minnesota. He's a legend, and he's done a good job with some phenomenal returns, but he's not, unfortunately, always going to be here. You know, we want him to stay for as long as possible, but someday he's going to retire and do some other things and enjoy that retirement. Hopefully it's not anytime soon, but at some point he will. And we may not have an investment manager who is as successful. So as you look at the third bullet point on chart 9, past performance doesn't guarantee future results. I think, you know, we're looking at the past, but we should also look into the future without Howard being here helping provide these amazing returns. And as the chairman talked about the red line, the 10-year, and as we look at the economy, global economic situation, issues that are going on, a prediction that the turn in the economy would happen in 2009 or 10 because of this housing bubble, and now predictions are it may be 2, 3, 4 more years. I think while it's important to look at the past, we also need to look into the future as we're determining what the assumed rate of return is. And I think more recent economic results perhaps bear a larger percentage of our attention than just what's happened 20, 25 years ago, because the economy is changing. The global environment is changing. So I'd agree with what the chairman had previously mentioned.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Beckham and Dr. Bannister, for being with us today. Appreciate your charts, graphs, all that. It's always very helpful. And I think I would want to say that in looking forward, that exactly is it. This is what our job is right now. And for me, I see it as the future pensions of the current employees should be paid for by current employees. In other words, they're putting money into those pensions to be invested, and we should not put at risk future employees or employers, or in our case, taxpayers, if we don't have a sound foundation and sufficient contributions at this time. I mean, that's really fundamentally what it's about, and it's the risk we take. The other thing is that in pensions, a little bit smaller amount early has the opportunity to compound. So I'm not too excited about waiting, because you miss the value of that positive compounding, and so it actually smooths it out for everybody going forward into the future by even a very small increase at an earlier period of time. So it really is about that future. And I don't know that the 80s and 90s and 2000s were tough, but we had two decades of pretty good. I don't know that the next 30 see us in that same kind of rolling 30-year average. So I think that the responsibility that weighs upon me, and I think upon all of us, is that is some future pension commission going to be glad at what we did, or say, doggone, you left us with a real risk here, and if you had done something earlier, we might have been able to have smoothed this out both for our pensioners, for our employers, for employees. And I really don't think the taxpayer should be on the hook, because this should be a system that pensions paid in and commitments made should be taken care of and not put the taxpayer at risk. So I think you've answered some of the other questions, the 10-year discussion and the 30-year still all reflect
a previous concept, and I don't question them, and I think they have a good value, but only in context. I'm looking ahead to the next 30 years, so, and I would rather do things earlier than waiting, because you can make a smaller correction and do okay than waiting longer. So it's just more of a comment, Mr. Chairman. I know we have so many other things on the agenda that I don't know that we need a response unless they would like to, but I think we have more information, too, to take a look at.
We do.
That would be helpful.
Senator Fogelman.
Just a technical question. Chart 10 is actual of Minnesota.
Correct.
Is 11 Minnesota, or that's a theoretical 80-20?
That's a theoretical 80.
Okay, so you can't really, you can't think of those two charts together. Okay.
Not necessarily because, yeah, your slide 10 is your actual asset allocation over that 30-year
okay.
period, and we didn't have indices that went back far enough to carry that over to slide 11.
And then, Mr. Chairman, one last question. So if you look at just 10, you need to think about when the 80-20, how long we've been 80-20 versus something else. That's a factor underneath
this. That would
this.
Be a factor.
And also, you need to think about the long-term slope of what's going on here of that line? And do we know if that's up or down at this point?
I'd like to.
Ms. Beckham?
I would try to extrapolate that for the next 30 years.
No, I mean the current. If you just take the current
11.
Slope, you drew a slope line in there, is it going up or down, or don't we know right? Do you know that answer right now? I'm just talking about mathematically.
Yeah. The next point on there we know because it's now occurred. We don't have the official numbers yet, but the next point, no idea.
Okay, no, I'm not asking about that point.
Yeah, right. No, I mean,
I'm talking about the slope of the whole graph.
I wouldn't even want to attempt it.
Yeah. I mean, the last 10 years have been, again, it's the last decade. I don't know if I should say it's the worst decade in history, but it's been a terrible decade. There's no doubt about it. The question is, you know, to me, the question is not what do the next 10 years look like. The question is what the next 30 years look like.
You want to know the next year.
I'm not trying to answer
your question. No, I'm not trying. That's not the question I'm asking. The question I'm asking is this whole chart deteriorating, or is this whole chart going up?
Well,
and we just,
that's
a mathematical.
If you're trying
right.
to draw a line down and it's going down,
okay.
yeah. But the last 10 years, given the last 10 years, it would. I mean.
But in terms of the question of what are.
It is. Maybe so just lay
just
a ruler down it.
So I just wanted to point out, Ms. Chairman, and Representative Khan's question, you were combining 10 and 11 and saying you were more interested in 11. And I think the caution there is. They're two different things.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only thing.
Right. Well, Ms. Chairman.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Pogamiller, Representative Lanning was using 8 and 12. But that wasn't what I wanted to talk about, Ms. Beckham, go back 14 in your options. I didn't quite understand. You said Vermont, the state of Vermont, is using select and ultimate rates?
Yes, they just made a change in their last experience study.
So we don't know if anything's changed for them yet.
Well, they've adopted a new set of assumptions. We do know what those assumptions are, if you're interested in that. Interesting. But they just will now be doing the first valuation with the new set of select and ultimate interest rates.
I see. Yeah. But who else, or you said that there's other groups that are using select and ultimate?
No, to my knowledge, Vermont is the only statewide system using select and ultimate. I said there's definitely interest from other statewide systems. One of our colleagues is doing a presentation in Colorado in a few weeks And one of the things they want to talk about is select an ultimate. It has this appeal of sort of blending short-term and long-term, and I think that's the reason it's sort of, I won't say catching on, because one system doesn't make it a trend, but why there's a lot of interest in it. People are struggling with kind of the information they're getting from their investment professionals, which is we would call short-term. They don't call it short-term, but, you know, it's a 10-year snapshot versus what they know they're setting a discount rate for a much, much longer period. So this is one approach, and it's not commonly used right now.
Do you know when did Vermont have the discussion about it, and when did they put it in place?
I can tell you that it was in their experience study that was completed this year. It was before June 30th, because I believe they're using it in the July 1, 2011 valuation, right, Brent?
Right.
Yeah. So it was earlier this year that the experience study was done. They do have kind of an interesting approach. Would you like to know what the rates that they're using?
Yeah.
They're actually not using one rate for the whole select period. They're actually using a different rate every year for the first 15 years and then an ultimate rate. It's interesting. Brent, you want to tell them what it looks like?
Yeah, they actually start off with the first year at 6.5%. That would be for the current 12-month period. We're in there saying 6.5 this year, 7.25 the next year, 7.5 the following year, 7.75 the following year, 2 more years at 8.25, 3 years at 8.5, 6 years at 8.75, and then 9% ultimately is what they believe. So they are going up to 9%. Eventually, because they believe that's what long-term their portfolio should yield. But at least in the short term, it's as low as 6.5.
And what was, Mr. Chair?
Representative.
And what were they before they went to 6? Is that what you said they started with?
Six, from 6.5.
Yeah, they were 8.25, I believe. They're, when they had a static single rate, it was 8.25. And then they've moved to this where, as you heard Brent say, they're starting at 6.5 and grading up ultimately to a rate of 9. And I believe that Brent had talked to the actuary that did the work on that, and I think they worked, both the actuary and the investment consultant worked very closely together on developing those rates. I mean, there's a fair amount of scientific methodology behind that.
Mr. Chair.
Members, we have a couple more important experts on this that we need to get to. Senator Rosen?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Beckman. To that question, how did Vermont back in the state contribution into that change? That's what you have to figure out, is how much it's going to increase over time, if the state can afford it, and if we could even have this lofty goal and perhaps even tie the hands of future legislators. That's another question. I mean, there is a considerable increase in the state's contribution of going from 8.25 down to 6.5, right?
Well, it's just 6.5 for 1 year.
Just 1 year.
And then it moves up to
7.0.
Yeah, right. And ultimately, if you think of all the benefit payments that are going to be made from the trust fund, a lot of them are going to be paid after 10 years from now. And they're getting bigger as they go out. Those are going to be discounted at 9% as opposed to the 8.25 that was being used before. So surprisingly, they did not include a financial analysis in the experience study. We are not the actuary for Vermont. So we've been digging around trying to find out as much as we can. The valuation obviously has not been completed yet, just as your July 2011 vals haven't been completed. So I think we'll know more when that comes out. I suspect that it did increase the liabilities and the costs. I don't know whether Vermont puts in the actuarial required contribution or if they have a statutory contribution. If there's interest, I'm sure, you know, several phone calls could probably find the answers to those questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
It was a very good presentation, but I do have a lot more questions now after looking into something or hearing about this select and ultimate rates.
Well, maybe we need to... Since they're relatively limited knowledge of this, I mean, we appreciate what you've shared. Maybe we need to look at it more deeply And I don't know if you folks can gather more information for us or if we need to call on someone else.
I think the answers to Senator Rosen's questions, I think we could probably assist with. Again, the actuarial public plan actuarial community is a pretty small group, and we all talk, and I think we can find out the questions to her, the answers to her questions, if that would be helpful, and report back.
Okay, we can do that if you if you would like. Are we ready to move to our next presenter? Ms. Beckham, Dr. Bannister, thank you very much for being here. And
my pleasure.
I assume that you'll be prepared to take some more questions from us.
Certainly.
Thank you. Dr. Stinson. Welcome, Dr. Stinson. We've had a series of discussions about these issues here in the last meetings we had back in September and now again today. So appreciate your coming here today and sharing your thoughts about assumptions that may be made about future growth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me start out by noting that I am not an actuary and I am not an expert on pensions or pension programs or anything like that. That said, I do have some economic thoughts about the proper discount rate, and I think that a prudent movement would be to reduce it from the 8.5 to the 8 level. The reason why I think that is that I think that over the next several decades, the best evidence is that we're going to have really quite slow labor force growth nationally. And if you don't have remarkable productivity growth nationally, you're going to have slower economic growth. Slower economic growth means slower corporate profit growth and slower equity growth as well. And so I think that looking on out into the future, the information that we have about past performance is likely to be overly optimistic. The potential offset for that would be to have higher than expected inflation. Inflation at this point is expected to be about 2%, in the 2% range looking on out 20 and 30 years. But of course, if you have higher inflation, that's going to mean other things equal weaker economy. And so the real growth that you're going to have in the economy, which is 2.5% the long-term rate that's now expected by Global Insight, would be noticeably lower, so you'd have slower growth in corporate profits, the real part of corporate profits as well, and slower equity growth. So for those reasons, and it seems to me that in reading just a couple of actuarial studies that have been done for other states, that the evidence would lead me to think that the prudent thing to do would be to reduce the rate from 8.5% to 8%.
Thank you very much for sharing your view about that. Could you also comment on assumptions about that may be prudent for us to follow relative to salary growth, employee growth, two other assumptions that we have in statute that we're in the process of evaluating as to where we ought to be with those?
I didn't prepare to do that. I can look up real quick and I can tell you what Global Insight is saying about wage growth over the next years. In terms of employee growth, I think that the number of employees is probably not going to grow particularly rapidly given the tight labor force that we expect to have going on out, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. The state demographers' estimates for labor force growth from 2020 to 2025, for example, is about 0.1%. And so it's not reasonable, I don't think, to think that we're going to have strong state employee growth or public employee growth over that period if the labor force as a whole is only growing by 0.1%. Let me see here. You know, I'm not going to be able to give you those numbers just real quickly here. I can certainly get back to you with those numbers.
I'd appreciate that, Dr. Stinson. It would be helpful to us to have your evaluation of those assumptions as well. And if you need further information from our staff, Mr. Martin, Mr. Burrick will be sure to get you that in terms of what we have on the books for that now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for Dr. Stinson? Thank you very much. Mr. Bicker. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, I was asked to give a review or input from the State Investment Advisory Council. The State Board of Investments Investment Advisory Council at its August meeting spent a good portion of time discussing this issue. The advisory council was asked by the directors of three statewide retirement systems to review the 8.5% assumed rate of return. The retirement directors gave some presentations related to the funded status of the plans and the assumed rates. The advisory council looked at the same financial data I provided to this commission at its last meetings. And the committee talked and had discussions for almost an hour. And they did not take a vote. They're advisory, and they are not really in a public policy setting mode. But I think there was definitely a leaning towards a more conservative number versus a more aggressive number. As has been discussed, many of these people are in corporate America where, because of the PBGC and the various other federal regulations, their discounting rate for liabilities is considerably lower than it is in the public arena. So, Mr. Chairman and members, there was no formal vote. There was a very definite leaning towards a more conservative versus a aggressive number. And if you would like any other information, we're more than willing to try to provide that to you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Director Becker, what is a conservative number?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, the discussion was between 8.5 and 8. So there was a leaning towards the 8 versus the 8.5.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Becker, then there had been discussions about splitting that in the middle, and no, you did not discuss that at all. It was just between 8 or 8.5. I hate to get a little picky, but there has been some numbers flying around.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rosen, many of these people on the advisory council are not in the public arena, they're usually not negotiating midpoints. They kind of do it one way or another.
Further question?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome, Mr. Bicker. Glad to see you here, and good to see you in good health. I think about the one question that I have for you that is to this, is that the difference between, on an annual basis, the dollars that get paid out and the contributions that come in, is that on par? In other words, do the dollar contributions equal the dollars paid out, or is there variation? Could you just cover that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kiffmeyer, the cash flow for the retirement systems, excluding investment income, just on contributions versus pension payments, we are negative around $150 million a month. So we are in a negative cash flow position, and we have been there for a few years.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do you see that trend line getting better of the negative, or, you know, reversing back up into parity, or do you see that line just kind of on an ongoing, steady decline?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kiffmeyer, the reality is those are really numbers for the retirement systems, but, you know, until there's a growth in employment and in government, you're probably going to continue to see those numbers be negative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Appreciate that. Members of the audience, we've had some people who have asked to be able to testify to various items on our agenda. And we have for this series of presentations Pat Anderson and Kim Crockett. We will, if there is somebody else who wishes to speak to the issues that we just heard about, we will be able to take your comments as well. So call on Pat Anderson and Kim Crockett would be on deck.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Pat Anderson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Free Market Institute. I'll testify very briefly. A lot of the points I wanted to make, actually, Representative Kiffmeyer made earlier, was discussing. I do want to point out that this discussion about the rate of return has been going on since long before some of us sat on the State Board of Investment. We had this discussion at that time. Maybe Howard would remember. I think it was going on a decade before that about changing the rate of return. At the time, we were advised not to rush things, and this is back during the good times. It's back, you know, 6-7 years ago, and now we've seen what's happened in the meantime. And I would encourage you, given all the information that you've received today, to consider a more realistic rate of return. I think 8.5 is one of the highest out there of public pension funds. We've hit it in the long run. We certainly haven't hit it in the short run. And what we heard from our own state economist, who tends to get it right in the forecasts, is that we're going to have a period of very, very slow growth. He also used the number, I think I heard him say 2% in inflation, and the actuaries earlier were talking about 3. So as you add up the 5, you know, which is the average, and 2, it really puts us around 7 or so. And so I think we have to be realistic about what's occurring. And if we're going to have a public pension system, the job would be obviously to make sure that it's intact and that the dollars that we're promising, you know, will exist when the time comes. And so I would encourage you as policymakers to do what you can to shore up this fund and to be realistic for future generations. I want to comment. I don't know much about the Vermont proposal. I think it would be – I'm would be very interested in seeing. And I'm also wondering why they would bump it up to the 9 later. I don't know if it's to make the actuarial numbers look better in the long term, because they're, I don't know if it's that or if they actually expect that we'll have 9% growth, you know, 5 years from now. But it would be, I would encourage you to take a look at it and try to find out what they were really getting at. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Ms. Krakow.
I want to briefly mention, I won't be here tomorrow, so I wanted to briefly just say something about the COLA issue. Okay. These two are, if I may, they're actually related. The right now we have a 2% or a 1%, I think, for para COLA until we're 90% funded. Should the actuarial number be dropped to 8 or something else, you're going to have a higher unfunded liability. So you, it will take longer to reach that 90%, which would then bump up the COLAs. And so they're very interrelated. If you were concerned about the COLA issue long term, whether 2% is appropriate or whether it should be lower like the 1%, you're going to be kicking, I don't want to say kicking this out, but if you change the rate of return down to 8, it will take a longer time to hit that 90% funding ratio. So, obviously. So, thank you. I'm not going to, I won't pick that up. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Crockett.
And, Mr. Chair, I wondered, at your discretion, I have more general comments about the pension system and not specifically about the assumed rate of return that I can hold for tomorrow or just give them now?
Well, maybe we ought to hold that. We've got you down for...
Oh, please.
As I understand, you wanted to visit about the plan's design changes, a hybrid potential?
Yeah, and I thought it would be helpful just to sort of wait and see what the discussion
okay.
is and then put it all in one.
Okay, well, let's do that. We'll give you a chance to come back.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to the discussion we've just had about the rate of growth assumptions? If not, we'll move to the next item on the agenda, back in the order of the printed agenda. Item 3, review of the July 1, 2010 replication actuarial evaluations for MSRS General, DERA General, and MER. We have Mr. Hogan and Mr. Herman from the Milliman firm, and who are now officially working for us. So welcome, gentlemen, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. For the record, I am Bill Hogan from Milliman, consulting actuary. To my left is my associate, Mr. Tim Herman, also a consulting actuary with Milliman. We work out of the Milwaukee office of Milliman, and we're very pleased to be here to present our information that we prepared last year from the actuarial reviews of the retirement systems. You should have a handout from us in your packet, and we'll follow along in that handout. Through the course of our presentation, we will be interchanging. Mr. Herman and I, myself, will pick up different aspects of this. Starting on page 2, just a brief informational slide about Milliman. And Milliman was founded in 1947. We have now 54 offices worldwide, and our revenues were just short of $700 million in 2010. We practice in all different kinds of benefits areas, life insurance, property and casualty, health insurance, employee benefits, pensions. Myself and Mr. Herman are pension actuaries. We've been working in the pension business our entire careers. And as a matter of fact, Milliman, one of our first clients at Milliman, or one of the first clients of Milliman by Mr. Wendell Milliman, was the state of Washington employee, government employer. On slide three, just an introductory slide of the team that will be working for you. Mr. Herman and myself will be the primary consultants that will interface with you directly, but we are adequately supported in the office. We have two other individuals who are fellows of the society, have achieved their enrollment status with the federal government, and are very knowledgeable on pensions, Mr. Alan Bittner and Tim Blake. We also will be obtaining expertise in a peer review capacity from our consultants in Philadelphia, who are also very, very strong actuaries in the government employer field, and then our actuarial staff. So we have the capability to serve you, and we look forward to doing that in this term. On slide four, we reviewed last year all of the retirement funds under our contract, which included the funds of the Minnesota State Retirement System, the funds of the Public Employees Retirement Association, the Teachers Retirement Association, the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund, and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. We provided a report that summarized the results of that review, and our intent today is to kind of describe what those what that report found. Now, as part of the review process and as part of our contract, we replicated two of the funds, and then the remaining funds were reviewed on a limited scope basis, with the idea being a replication of all of the funds is probably was not put in our contract, and in our opinion probably is not warranted every year, because once we've replicated it, unless there's significant changes, the fund is going to operate pretty much in the same manner, or the calculations should be reasonably consistent from year to year by the same actuary. Just a quick review of the audit process. In a replication review, we are taking the information that the fund actuary receives, and we are doing essentially the same steps that the fund actuary is doing on an independent basis. So we're essentially preparing our own valuation of that fund from start to finish. And then at the end, we look to compare our results with the fund actuary and identify differences, and some we can resolve and some we can't, and then we comment on anything that you know, remains different between the two of us. That as opposed to a limited scope review, which is closer to a peer review process, where we're not going to try and replicate all of the work. It's a process where we're going to take reasonable steps to feel comfortable that the work is being done correctly without the certainty of actually duplicating the results. So we take a number of steps to try and identify the calculations and how they're being made without actually running all the numbers and summarizing them. In both types of review, we look at different aspects of the valuation process. In the first aspect, the membership data, both are fairly similar in that we're obtaining a full data file from the fund, and we're running that data file to make sure that we arrive at the same control totals and counts that the fund actuary is coming up with. So in that sense, we feel confident in either type of review that we've got the data adequately captured, at least, and it's being summarized correctly. We also review the financial data that's provided by the fund And we look pretty much similarly in both types of reviews to make sure that we agree with how that data was summarized by the fund actuary and make sure that we agree that the items were contained in the report correctly. We are not auditing that data that's provided by the fund actuary per se. We're accepting that data as given to us, and our primary goal in that sense is to just make sure that the data we're getting is being treated similarly by the fund actuary as the way we would see the requirements in the standards. The benefits that are valued, this is where the replication valuation provides a little more assurance in the sense that we are actually programming those benefits into our system and running our system to see what we would get on the entire population that we've been given. In the limited scope review, we are looking at sample data lives and trying to compare how an individual run through our system compares to an individual run by the fund actuary and identifying where we think those calculations might be different or the same and verifying that we agree or at least are comfortable that the calculation of that particular individual by the fund actuary is being valued correctly. We do enough of a sample so that we're comfortable that the different types of calculations that are contained in the system are adequately addressed in the programming by the fund actuary. But we don't have assurance of the final calculations or the summarized calculations of all the members of the from the data file in the limited scope review. So that's where we're making the judgment that we think there's reason to believe they're correct because on an individual basis the calculations are being done correctly. With respect to the actuarial assumptions, we are verifying through the sample life process and through the summary in the report that the assumptions the fund actuary is using reflect the assumptions we believe should be used. Sometimes through a replication process, we might find more generic assumptions that we need to review because we're not matching numbers and discover some things. But in general, we are able to match all of the assumptions generally in a sample life calculation. Similarly, with the actuarial methods, we are looking at the calculations produced in the sample lives versus what's produced in aggregate in the funding method. In this case, it's the entry age normal method, and we sometimes we have differences, and that's not uncommon, as we'll see, is the differences in how different valuation systems produce these numbers. If we have differences, we try and understand why those are different, and if we can't reconcile it, depending on how different they are, that determines whether or not we feel the need to make a significant comment about it or if we think it's within the reasonable tolerance that the actuarial profession allows. So that's kind of an understanding of the differences. So moving ahead to six, I kind of was talking about that a little bit already, but with respect to the replications, as we mentioned, we did three replications. We replicated the Para General Fund, the MSRS General Fund, and the MIRF Division of Para. And so in our summary of results, the numbers we produced in those groups were on a replication basis, and we reached what we considered to be reasonable tolerances in those funds. The remaining funds were done on a limited scope basis, and in our report we detailed some of the information that we found there. We feel, based on our work last year, that we can give a high degree of confidence that we understand what's going into the calculations by the fund actuary and that, by and large, those calculations are reasonable. So based on that, what I'm going to do is ask Tim to just kind of talk about audit guidelines and give you some of his information about that.
Thank you, Bill. Again, we're on page 7 now. As far as the audit process is concerned, there's no formal or published guidance that directs us exactly how to proceed with doing it or what the thresholds are used to make that judgment about whether or not the fund actuary is doing things according to the actual standards. Generally, what we're looking at is when we're doing a replication valuation is to look at percentage differences between the results that we produced compared to the results that the fund actuary produces. We're talking about some pretty big numbers here. So, for example, the TRA fund has about $22 billion of accrued liability. So if we would consider about a 0.5% difference to be reasonable, we're still talking about $110 million difference. So it's not small dollar amounts that we're talking about, but in the aggregate, we would look at a 0.5% difference to be a reasonable difference. The differences arise from two different perspectives. One is that most of the actuarial firms have their own developed software, and if you ask two different actuaries how to do something, you're going to get at least two different answers. That's one of the sources that goes into the programming of the systems, so that's one of the differences that comes out in the valuation process. And even amongst the different approaches, there are differences of opinion amongst different actuaries about how to do things. And even though they're different, they could be both reasonable approaches. So those are two of the sources that go into some of the differences that we see when we do a replication evaluation. And then lastly, you've already heard testimony from Ms. Beckham and Mr. Bannister. Actuarial science is not an exact science. There are differences that between different actuaries. And we're really looking for a reasonable assurance that the overall process is reasonable. Page 8 wanted to highlight some of the different changes that came into effect with the 2010 valuations. You made significant changes to the plan provisions in your funds, made some rather significant changes to the actual assumptions and the methods. First, I want to kind of just highlight two of the major differences in the plan provisions. Most of your funds, you have reduced the post-retirement adjustment. You have scaled back the cost of living adjustment that you're giving to retirees until the fund reaches financial stability. And then you've also adopted different contribution rate increases that kind of vary from fund to fund and from year to year. The third kind of set of different plan provision changes that you've made are really getting at scaling back the benefits that are provided to members that leave the system before they reach retirement eligibility. And then, of course, the details vary on a fund-by-fund basis. Overall, the 2010 valuation results show that by making these changes, you've reduced the liability of the systems by about $6 billion. You've made some pretty significant changes in the benefits that are being offered under your pension plans in order to bring them back into